Parshas Vayishlach is crucial in so many ways, but especially at this point in history and this week when anti-Semitism has tragically been displayed in such an undeniable fashion. The relevance of Parshas Vayishlach takes on additional components. We have a Mesorah that in any kind of confrontation with the forces of Esav, however we understand that you look to Parshas Vayishlach for inspiration. You look for guidance from Yaakov's preparation for his confrontation with Esav. And this is something that I find the Gemara tells us that Ovadia took guidance from looking at what Yaakov did. Maybe we'll talk about that in the context of the Pasuk. And the Ramban notes that there are a number of lessons from this aliyah, from this whole episode, that were meant to take away l'doris. Among them, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu saves Yaakov, that see Yaakov doesn't rely on his tzidkus. We'll look at that more carefully. That this is something that will come up again in the future, and that therefore we should take lessons from it. So we should pay careful attention to all of the details of this aliyah and try to understand what we can take away from it. So to get into the actual words, so the parsha is called Vayishlach. So Yaakov sends Malachim. How come now all of a sudden? Why now is he sending Malachim? So some of the Rishonim say that he was going to be traveling nearby to Esav, and he was afraid that Esav would find out about it and he would come out and fight with him. And others understand that this flows from the very end of last week's parsha, that the parsha ends with Yaakov halach l'darko, v'yifku vo malachei elokim. That Yaakov finds that he has angelic escorts. So maybe he perceived that there was a danger, that there was something that he had to address, and that's why they're there. So that's probably relevant to the next word also. So v'yishloch Yaakov malachim lefanav. Yaakov sent messengers. So most of the Rishonim understand that this means messengers, human messengers. But Rashi reflects another opinion, and interestingly only another opinion. Not that maybe it's messengers that are human, and maybe not. Rashi just tells us, Malachim Amish, actual angels. So that's interesting where the Hechrich is to say that way. The Moshe of Zakenim understands that that's also because of this previous reference that we just saw 2 psukim ago. If we cross the border into the previous parsha, that there are angels who he meets up with. So now we're being told he sends angels. So Mustalmit means that these are the angels who he sent. And the Orach Chaim explain why it is that he's sending angels and not human beings. It's either because he was afraid that Esav is not going to respect people, or that he would kill the people. And he was afraid that people would be vulnerable. So you're going to send messengers on a dangerous mission. Probably a good idea to send angels rather than people. That's safer. There's clearly a lot more to understand about the idea of sending angels. I'm not sure if I can tell you how to understand it, but I can tell you that it's something that is discussed. For example, Tzadik HaKohen, I believe in the Sirkas HaTzadik, has a whole lot to say about this, great detail that is way beyond either our time or our ability to properly appreciate. But there is a lot written about it. I remember when I first came across that, so I, for some reason, looked on Wikipedia about Reb Tzadik HaKohen. So the Reb Tzadik HaKohen, among his other expertises and talents, is described there as an angelologist. So apparently that is a discipline. A certain Bikias and Havana and angels and how they operate. So there's a lot here that is beyond us. You should just know that there's definitely a lot written about these angels and the idea that he's sending them. So where does he send them? El Esav Achiv, Arts the Seir, Stei Edom. He sends them to Seir. So the Mefarshim discussed that didn't Esav live in Canaan? So they have different approaches that maybe Yaakov had heard at the time that he was in Seir, or maybe by now he had moved. And the Netziv suggests that he was between both places, But Yaakov specifically wanted to catch him there in Seir because he didn't want to catch him when he was near Yitzchak, because, as we'll see, to figure out what exactly the point of this mission was, but to the extent that he wanted to gauge where Esav was holding, so who knows, if he was in front of Yitzchak, he wouldn't necessarily get a honest impression. So he wanted to catch him when he was alone, catch him when he was separated from Yitzchak, and that's why he wanted to catch him in that location. So what's the nature of the mission? So Vitzavo Som Lemor, Kol Sumerun La Adoni Le Esav, Kol Amar Avdecha Yaakov, Imlovan Garti, Voichar Arato. So he commands them to say, here's what you shall say to Lavan, here's what you shall say to Esav, I have lived with Lavan, and I have been delayed until now. So, first of all, he says to him, this is what you should say, before we know what the content is. So why does it say, Ko Somerun? I remember many years ago, I just came across, I was looking at my father's farm, and I found a sefer called the Minchas Machva Salat Torah. And I think this was the only thing I read in it, but it stands out, that he said on this pasuk, that why does it say, Ko Somerun? So he suggested that it's because we have Masorah had to interpret the word ko, say, this is how you should speak. The Gemara in Sota tells us that it has to be B'lashon HaKodesh. We find that in the context of Birchas Kohanim, for example, that you would have thought Birchas Kohanim could be done in any language. So the Gemara says that no, Kol Sevarchun, it has to be B'lashon HaKodesh. So maybe that's what's going on here also, that Yaakov was saying, you have to repeat my message exactly, you have to repeat it in Lashon HaKodesh. So why should that be? So he suggests, because we all know the famous Rashi, that we'll say more about in a minute, that in Malavon Garti, so Garti is a reference to rearrange the letters, it's Tayag, Tayag Mitzvah Shamarti. So there's a gematria, there's a word jumble in the pasuk, so you have to keep it in the original language, otherwise it's not going to make sense. You're going to convey it in Hebrew in order for it to have its meaning. So that's a creative interpretation. But the Rishonim also discuss why it says ko. The Radak, for example, understands that he's saying, say it exactly like this, because the next part about the idea of saying Adoni le'esav and saying Avdecha Yaakov, that he wants to make sure that Esav should appreciate that he talks like this, even not in his presence. So he should know that he respects him. While the Ramban understands differently, the Ramban says that this part wasn't actually said to Esav, but that he talked like this in front of the messengers, so the messengers should kind of intuit the style and the format, and when they talk to Esav, they'll talk like that. So, okay. But what's the whole purpose of this mission, in addition to the content? So here, again, Rishonim have different things to say. Rashi and the Chizkuni understand that it's about making peace. The Radak and the Radbaz, they emphasize that he's acting friendly here because he wants to try to create this kesher, so that's why he's also talking about his life. He's updating him on his recent events, and Lavan Garti, etc., etc. Others suggest that that idea of filling you in on what's happening is the lashon of an eved to his master, that he has to report, he has to give an accounting of what he's doing, so he's trying to convey the respect that way. Some of the Rishonim assume, like we indicated before, that the purpose of this mission was to gauge Esav. He wanted to just get a sense of where Esav was holding, whether he was going to be belligerent against him or not. So that was the point. The Torah Shlomo, which quotes the Midrashim, quotes the Medrash Abir, says there are five purposes in this mission. One, to see if Esav is cooled down, to know exactly how strong he is, how much might he has to worry about, to try to defuse his kinah, to be notel rishos from him, and also to be machnif him, to flatter him, so that maybe that'll help. The Rash ben Chofni also notes that maybe he wants Esav to take him seriously, so that's why he's going to talk about it to the next pasuk. He's going to talk about his success. He's going to emphasize that. So this idea of talking about him, Lavan Garti, just before you get to that Rashi, but the literal intent of saying, I have lived with Lavan. So Rashi understands that he's trying to make the point that you shouldn't be jealous of me because it's not such an impressive life I've been living. Lo na'aseisi sar v'choshev ela ger. I was just a foreigner in his place. I was not of stature. Eincha kedai l'snosi ala brachos v'icha shebrecheni. That you shouldn't be jealous of the brachos that our father gave me because, look, this is what I've been doing. I've been an outsider in loved one's house. The Chizkuni explains that he wants to convey to him that all the gifts that he has, he's bringing now, came from Lavan, and he shouldn't think it came from the brachos. It's consistent with that point. Also, he notes that he wants to say to Esav, don't be upset that I haven't come to you till now, but I was busy with Lavan, so that's why I was distracted. That's why I wasn't able to come to you. The Ralbag comments that this is all part of trying to build Esav's trust. So he's just laying everything out there, saying, I'm telling you my whole story. I'm not hiding anything. You should trust me. And others suggest that the reference to Lavan is also to try to butter up Esav by saying that I did all this work, so I would have something to give you. Also point out that Lavan has a stature, so part of this mixed goal of, on the one hand, trying to play down his success, but also he wants to get some respect from Esav, wants to be taken seriously. So on the one hand, I was a ger, but I was a ger for the chashuv guy, for Lavan, so he should take me seriously. And again, to go back now to Rashi's point about Tarek Mitzvah Shamarti, so one way or another, one could raise the question of why is that important to Esav? So why is Esav? Is Esav his mashkiach? He needs to know that he has been from the whole time. Why is that important? So it could be he's trying to convey a sense of balance, that, okay, I've had these material accomplishments, and I've also maintained my spirituality. I think we mentioned in Parshas Toldos that the Rashi of Karen Biavne had a whole mahalach towards why Yitzchak wanted to give the brachos to Esav, because he thought he was the one who could keep the spirituality and the involvement in the physical world in balance with each other, and he thought that Yaakov was kula ruchni. So here Yaakov is saying that I was successful in accomplishing both. I did everything in Lavan's house and still tayag mitzvah shamarti. Or maybe it's possible, especially considering the gematria and the difficulty of seeing on a literal level how he's saying this, maybe this is a way of him actually speaking to himself. It's not necessarily a point that was meant to be picked up by Esav, but it's his way of saying that you should know that, I should appreciate for myself that I kept my spirituality in place, even though I had all kinds of temptations and I had all kinds of challenges. And perhaps it's a parallel to what we also see in Parshas Toldos, that when he says, Anochi Esav Becharecha, and there Rashi tells us that he's saying, well, Anochi Hamevi Lecha and Esav Becharecha, the question presents itself, that is that really an honest statement, if you're just phrasing your words in such a way to mean two different things. So, once again, the Rashi of Karen Biavne and others explain that he was saying one thing out loud, and to himself, he was trying to make sure that his internal compass was solid. So he had to maintain an emes, even as he was necessarily saying something that was a little bit deceptive. And maybe here also, so there's one thing he's saying out loud, but there's something that he is telling himself in order to maintain his balance, perhaps. The usage of the word Adoni, so it's interesting. So, okay, so he's saying Adoni in order to make Esav happy, but it was always something that bothered me about a comment of the Ramban here. And I wrote about this many years ago, and then only after that discovered a possible approach to it, which then I was able to add in later, that it seems to be maybe a stira in the Ramban. Because the Ramban over here comments that why is he saying Adoni le'esav? Because he's trying to make a point that even though I bought the Bechor from you, even though you're no longer the Bechor, I'm the Bechor, So you might think that I don't have to respect you anymore. I'm trying to display that I don't think that that's important. I'm trying to display that I still treat you as if you're the Bechor. So what's the problem with that comment? So it seems like, and from a Lamdisha sense, that it's against the Ramban L'shitaso, because there is a din, I can tell you from my personal experience, a very important din, of Kavod Acha Gadol, that the older brother gets Kavod, similar perhaps to the Kavod of a parent. And there is a machlokas why that is. I think we spoke about it a little bit in one of the previous weeks. But there is the view of the Rambam that it's about the din of Bechor, and therefore, presumably, it would really only apply to the oldest brother and not any older sibling. But it's the din that the Bechor is Yorish Gedulas Aviv, and that's why you get respect. And according to the Ramban, it's a whole different thing. It's a prat in Kibbut Aveim, that one of the aspects of Kibbut Aveim is that you should do what makes the parents happy. And presumably most parents want that there should be a hierarchy among the children, that the younger children should respect the older children, and therefore maybe, as others point out, it would apply even to older siblings, brothers or sisters, whether they are the older or the oldest. So if the Ramban understands that it's not about the Bechor, it's about the parental preferences, so here, why is he focusing on the Bechor? It doesn't have relevance. And especially if it is about parental preference, so we know that Yitzchok actually, on one level or another, seemed to prefer Esav. So why is the Ramban understanding that he's bringing the Bechor in here as if it's relevant? So later, I was zoche to see that it's a sefer called Eish Tamid al Torah. Actually, many, many svarim by that title, but one of the many svarim called Eish Tamid is written by a fine Talmud Chacham I have the privilege of being acquainted with, by Shlomo Sinneman from Brooklyn, where he explained, he has various proofs to this, that when you say Acha Gadol, you say the brother who is greater, so to speak, the brother who is older, is that you don't count by hours or minutes. Godless. You count it by years or at least days. So when you have twins, so even though one is technically older than the other by however many minutes, but that's not called Gadol Me'achi. That's not called somebody who is actually older than the other. And presumably also within this family hierarchy idea, as you say, that there's not necessarily a kpeda among the parents that the younger twin should have special deference to the older twin. So that din that the Ramban talks about there, the general older sibling din, that wasn't really relevant to them. So the only thing that was relevant is the Bechora that has its own significance. So that the Yaakov is saying, the Bechora, I'm not machshiv that, I respect you anyway. Okay, so that could be. In any event, so the next pasuk, he goes on to say, Vayhi li shor v'chamor, son v'eve v'shivcha, v'yashlucha l'hagid l'adoni l'msochein v'einecha. So I have all these things, and I have sent a message to you in order to try to find favor in your eyes. So Yaakov Kamenetsky points out, he always has the sensitivity to the trup and the punctuation. So he notes out that there's kind of a pause here, drawn between Shor v'Chamor on the one hand, and then Son v'Eve v'Shivcha separate from that. So you can take a look there to see how he explains it. But in the Paris Yosef, just he has a symbolic understanding of the idea of Shor v'Chamor, and he suggests that maybe that's its own point, that it's coming to address the point about Im Lo Vangarti Tarig Mitzvah Shamarti, that once I'm telling you that I kept the Torah, kept all the mitzvahs, you shouldn't think it was easy. You shouldn't think that I had no nisyonos. I did have yitzharas, and that's what shor v'chamor is symbolic of, because shor symbolizes yitzharas ben adam l'chavero, because the shor is one of the avos nezikin, so and nezikin is said symbolic of all sensitivity ben adam l'chavero. The Gemara says that one of the ways to become chassid, to become pious, is to learn carefully the laws of nezikin, so it's symbolic of the whole concept. And chamor is like chumrius, is the gashmius that represents nisyonos on the level of ben adam l'makom. And he's trying to say that I had challenges, there were yitzharas, and yet I managed to fight them off. And therefore, it's significant that I say tarik mitzvah shamarti. Okay, so the next pasuk says, "V'yashuvu hamalachim el Yaakov lemor banu el achich el Esav v'gam holech likrascha v'arbar meos ishimo." So they came back and they said, "We went to Esav and he's on the way to see you with 400 men." So did they give the message? Did they say what they were supposed to say? So it's not so explicit here. What was the reaction? So the Rishonim have different interpretations of what happened and what's not being identified in the pasuk. Some say, yes, they sent a message, and that was expected, so therefore the pasuk doesn't have to tell you that that's what happened. Others say that they sent a message, but Esav didn't take it well, and that's why he was storming towards them. And others say that, no, they figured there's no point in giving the message, because the message was to go Arza Seir, and then they're on their way, and they see that he's on his way, so they figure, okay, this whole message of trying to appease him, it's too late, because he's coming with the army, so they run back, and they basically say, we started out, and now we see that he's on the way here, so you should know. So that's assuming that the Arba Meos Ish are there as a military battalion, which is how many of the Rishonim understand it. Others say, maybe not, maybe it was meant as an expression of kavod, that he was coming to greet his brother, and he took these large numbers of people with him to that point, and some say he switched in the middle, that maybe he came as a force of attack, and then he got the message that Yaakov's trying to be nice, so then he said, okay, we'll come with all these men to be mechabed him. There's a medrash that says that the 400 is evocative of the promise, the negative promise of 400 years of slavery in Mitzrayim. What does that got to do with anything? Because the Medrash conveys that Esav got a license from Mitzrayim to collect taxes. We're just talking this week in business class about people who collect taxes not legitimately. The Gemara says that taxes from the legitimate government you have to pay. But sometimes there are people who are illegitimate tax collectors, and they got a deal that they were allowed to collect on their own, but it wasn't for the benefit of society. So that maybe Esav had this ability now to try to collect taxes from Yaakov when he was coming with a whole team in order to enforce that. And the 400 is evocative of the original plan of 400 years of slavery in Mitzrayim. Okay, so in any event, that does not make Yaakov happy. So this next pasuk, very, very significant. Vayiro Yaakov ma'od vayetzelo. So Yaakov was very afraid, and he was concerned about this. So why was he so afraid? So didn't he have a haftacha? Didn't we, even those of us who only learn Rishon, so we know from Rishon of Vayetze that God made him a promise that he's going to watch out for him. So now we're in Rishon of Vayishlach, and he's got a threat. So why is he so concerned? Why shouldn't he be confident that he's going to be safe? So the Gemara Maseches Brachos in the first parakah in Daf Dalet, the Gemara says that he understood there was a promise, but he thought that maybe on his side, maybe he lost out because Shema Garim Hachet, maybe he did something wrong, and he was no longer worthy of this promise. Many of the Rishonim, and many of the Mefarshim overall, they ask a question on this. So for example, the Reim in his commentary on Rashi and others raised the question that why should that be a realistic concern? That maybe Yaakov had lost his chus, and therefore the promises shouldn't be coming. Now, the Gemara says in Masech Shabbos and Daf Nun Hei that if a Kadosh Baruch Hu sends a Nevuah L'Tova, so then that never changes. A Nevuah L'Ra, that can be undone by Tshuva. But a Nevuah L'Tova is going to always stay. So then Yaakov should have been confident that no matter what he did, he was still going to get this promise. So there's an approach some have. The Rambam discusses this also in his introduction to the Perush HaMishnayos. And he explains, based on what he writes also in Mishneh Torah, in Hilchos Yesodei Torah, Parag Yud, Halacha Dalet, where he explains this whole idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu never will reverse a Nevuah L'Tova. That, there's a reason for that. That is because, really, you should say that the same way, if it's a bad Nevuah, so if they do tshuva, it should get reversed. So if it's a good Nevuah, if they lose their Zchus, that should also get reversed. So why not? because we have a halacha of Navi Sheker. We have to be able to tell who's a real Navi and who's a fake Navi. And how's that going to work? So you could say, well, it's easy. If they predict things and it comes true, they're a real Navi. And if they predict things and they don't come true, then they're a fake Navi. But we see that's not so simple, because sometimes the circumstances could change. So maybe they're a real Navi, but things change because the people did tshuva or the like. So we need to have something that's a reliable absolute. So a good nevuah, that's the absolute, and that's going to be reflective of whether the Navi is real, because that we can bank on. Well, a bad nevuah, so that we can hope that tshuva will undo it. So if a Navi promises something bad and then it doesn't happen, maybe it's because of tshuva. But a good nevuah, that's what we're going to have as absolute proof that the Navi is legit. So if that's the case, so then it could be that it's not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is never going to change something that he's predicting for good, but it's only specifically when you have a Navi who's conveying a message to the Rabbim, and we need to be able to know whether he's real or not. So then we have to have this system that whatever the Navi is told, that he then conveys to the public, that's going to be solid. But if somebody is given a nevuah about himself, Yaakov is told that here's what's going to happen, so then maybe it is possible that could get reversed. So that's one suggestion here. I wonder why it also maybe could be that maybe Yaakov wasn't aware of this cloud. Maybe he just, okay, he was scared because he thought that it could be that it was reversible. But maybe in a Hanami, maybe it wasn't reversible. But what I also don't understand even more is a question that some of the Mefarshim ask on the next part, because they say, Vayira Yaakov Ma'od Vayetzer Lo, that Yaakov was very scared and concerned. So why? So Rashi tells us he was afraid, Shemei Hareg, he was afraid that maybe he'll get killed. And he was concerned that maybe he would kill someone else. So some of the Mefarshim ask a question which I really don't understand. They ask, well, why should he be worried about that? We have a klal that a rodef, you're allowed to kill, so fine, what's to worry about? So it would seem that it's that it should be easy to understand, or should be clear, I think, what he's concerned about, because even in Timsi Lomar, that he could do this perfectly, which itself is always a question. If a person is defending himself in a warlike context, so you have to really hope that you're only hurting people who actually are trying to hurt you. But even if we knew that for sure, that the people you're hurting are actually rodfim, so still nobody wants to kill somebody and have that a part of their history, even if it was necessary. You'd far prefer that you don't have to. And many poskim feel that a kohen who kills even in self-defense, machlokes poskim, but it could be that even a kohen who kills in self-defense is still not able to do brachas kohenim. Again, there's a lot written about that, but that's certainly a possibility. And we find that David HaMelech was excluded from making the Beis HaMikdash because he had killed in war. So it's not nothing to kill a rodev. So I'm not sure why it's hard to understand why Yaakov would want to avoid this. And in fact, this is a major theme the Bali Musar have, the theme later in the parasha. It's beyond Rishon, but we'll just quickly make reference to it. You know that when Dina is attacked, so there is the suggestion, Chazal, that Yaakov bore some responsibility for this because he concealed Dina from Esav, and that maybe she could have had a hashbah, maybe Esav would have married her. That's what he was afraid of, that Esav was going to marry her. But maybe that would have been good for Esav. Maybe she would have brought him around to the good side. So, therefore, there's some kitru on Yaakov. That's very difficult to understand because, you know, God willing, you know, someday have daughters to marry off. We don't usually advise that when you're trying to find a shidduch for your daughter, you should try to find the worst possible guy, because that way you can have the best impact on that person. And the better your daughter is, the more you should find somebody who's a terrible guy, because she'll do the most good. And it's not the way we normally recommend shidduchim. I don't think any responsible father-in-law is going to look for a shidduch with that kind of understanding. So clearly Yaakov was right to not want his daughter to marry off Esav. So the Bali Musar explained that this is similar to a comment in the Medrash that says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was told to make the second set of luchos, the Torah says, psol lucha, that you should now make the second set of luchos. And the Medrash says that you should do it because you should know how expensive these things are. You just throw them off the side of a mountain, you think it's nothing. You should know what goes into making a set of luchos. So that's very challenging, because it sounds like that Esav, sounds like there that Moshe is being criticized for breaking the luchos, and our tradition is that it was maybe the last words of the Torah. Our tradition is that Moshe was right in breaking the luchos. So why is he being criticized? By Moshe, explain that no, Moshe did the right thing. Yaakov did the right thing also. But the criticism here is that just because you're doing what's necessary, it doesn't mean that you don't have to worry about the negative consequences. You still should have rachmanis about the negative consequences, which is meduyuk in the language of that idea with Moshe and the luchos. Yeah, you were right. You had to break the luchos, but you shouldn't think it was nothing. You should know what the luchos cost. So you should make your own set the second time. You should appreciate what it is. So when it comes to Yaakov here depriving Esav of this opportunity, yeah, that's what he had to do. There's no question. He had to protect Dina and to not prioritize Esav. But he should shed a tear for Esav. He should have a little bit of appreciation for what was not going to happen. And that's what they suggest, that maybe there's some indication that he was too cavalier about that, that he didn't have a sense of rachmanis for what wasn't going to be able to be done for Esav, and maybe that's what the kitrig is. So certainly, you could understand, why does he not want to kill a rode if he doesn't want to have to be in that situation? And, you know, that could really be what the whole combination here is. Vayira Yaakov Ma'or Vayitzelo is essentially to say that he's in a bad situation. It's a lose-lose situation, because on the one hand, Vayira, I'm afraid that I'm going to get killed. And if you're going to tell me, well, there's a haftacha, whatever, I'm not going to get killed, so then, vayitzelo, well, then maybe that's going to mean I'm going to have to kill him, and I don't want that either. So this is a lose-lose situation. So that's a very big concern. That's what he's upset about. And indeed, the language of vayitzer, some of Mepharshim understands milashon tzara, it's anguish. Rabbeinu Ephraim writes, it's like we say, Beit HaMetzarim. We talk about the 3 weeks. We call that being between the straits, that we are confined, that we feel like we don't have any room, it's too narrow. So essentially seeing the paths narrow, that my options are very limited right now, it's not going to end up well. Either I die or he dies, that's a very bad situation. It's too narrow. You got to find a third option where it's neither of those things. And maybe that's what he's conveying here, that this is what he's upset about, that either way it's going to be something bad unless we can find a way to make this into a different kind of encounter. Unless we can change the atmosphere here, we're only going to have bad options. There is a fascinating essay, this is probably the third time today I'm mentioning him, but Rashiv Karen Biavner of Goldwicht in the Asufas Marachis has a very fascinating piece here where he notes that Medrash says that Yaakov was the Bechir Sheva Avos. He was the most chosen of the Avos. And we mentioned that last week when talking about, despite that fact, that his Meirav is apparently Rishus. So here this Medrash makes this comment that Yaakov was the most chosen of the Avos. And yet he ends up in the situation of Vayira Vayetze. He ends up in the situation of great tension. So the Rashiva discussed what exactly is the point of that Medrash. And he notes that we have an idea that there are various matanos that a Kadosh Baruch Hu gives us. He gives us the Torah, he gives us Eretz Yisrael. And Chazal say it was all given with Yisurin. It was all given through affliction. So what's the point of that? That God wants to give us things and he wants us to suffer also? Why should that be? So he explained that, and this is a theme that Rashiva came back to very often, but here he was focusing on a certain aspect of it, that everything in life that we have, we want to make a kinyan on. That when we have something, but it's not really ours, it's been given to us for free, or it's been given to us on loan, there's no real sense of bialis, there's no real sense of ownership. And he would explain there that this is a very different spin on what the Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Ezehu Ashir, Hasameach B'chelko. So it's normally translated that to be wealthy, you have to be happy with what you have, Sameach B'chelko. So you would say, no, it's not about that you're content, it's about the Sameach B'chelko, that what you have is yours. What you have, you've really acquired legitimately. you don't have to worry that somebody's going to come and take it back, or that somebody's going to deprive you because it was never really yours in the first place. So there's always a need for effort and for kinyan in order to acquire things. This is all the more so. That's true by ruchnius kinyan and by spirituality. All the more so, there has to be a kinyan, because that's its very nature. So you know, you could maybe inherit an item, and then maybe it doesn't really require much in order to be konin. But something that's a part of your spiritual makeup, it's always going to have to involve some type of a kinyan in order for it to be real. But what's also different about a spiritual acquisition rather than a material acquisition is that a spiritual acquisition, maybe we can get on credit, so to speak, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu invests in us first, and then the kinyan comes afterwards. So essentially, Yaakov was the Bechir. He was the most chosen. He was given all of these spiritual kochos, but he knew it was going to come at a cost, that he's going to have to live up to it. He's going to have to do what's necessary in order to make sure that this is actually a part of him. So he's hoping, okay, so I got these promises in the beginning of Vayetze, and then I had this whole turbulent life throughout Parshas Vayetze. I hope that I'm now on the Madrega that I have actually acquired this. But Shemagara Machet, I also recognize that even a small thing might get in the way, because the chait isn't necessarily about a punishment, but it's about my failing to actually become the kind of person that is worthy of all of this. And that's where he was concerned, and that's what the Medrash was saying, that it's specifically this Bechir Sheba Avos who had to feel this tension. Okay, have I been able to do what's necessary in order to be kona the spiritual gifts that are meant to be a part of me? It's a fascinating idea. Okay, so he's very concerned. So what does he do? So Vayachetz es ha'am asher ito, v'yasatzon, v'yasabakar, v'hagmalim, l'shnei machnos. So he divides up everything that he has into two camps. So why did he do that? So the next pasuk explains that he wants to make sure that there's going to be part that's saved, and even if one part gets hit, part will be saved. Next pasuk says, "V'yomrim yavo Esav l'machne ha'achas v'yikov v'yamachne ha'nishra v'fleita." So if Esav comes to get one, so then he'll at least have the other one that's going to survive. So the Bechor Shor comments that it's strategic in that way, that it's going to hopefully save the other camp, but also it's going to confuse Esav, because maybe Esav is going to look at him and say, okay, this guy's coming to do battle with me, and instead of calling for reinforcements, he's having his troops. That doesn't seem to make sense. And that's also a part of the strategy. He would confuse him and not going to understand what's going on, and maybe that also would help, so he wouldn't necessarily think that it's a military effort. The Or HaChaim comments that the nature of the setup was that the group that the Esav would see, that would be the happy group. That would be the group that would be there to welcome him in a peaceful fashion. And if it turns out that Esav's not looking for peace, so then this other group is hidden and they can do Mohammed. And this is what the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, that Ovadia learned from Yaakov, that when he was trying to hide the Nevi'im from Yizevel, who was killing off the Nevi'im, so he divided them up into two groups. And the Gemara says that he learned this from Yaakov. This idea that the second machane would be lefleita, that the second machane would be saved. So, you know, hopefully, but we know that it's not a given, because nowadays, Rahman al-Aslan, we see that terrorists sometimes have coordinated attacks. They can come from two directions at once. It's not necessarily going to help to divide up into two halves. So the Mefarshim discuss both why he was so sure that this would be. You know, maybe he was relying on the bracha to some extent, so maybe he wasn't sure if the bracha would cover everybody, but at least it should cover somebody, so at least one of these camps would end up being protected. Or maybe he figured Esav's going to be tired out from battling the first one, so he's not going to be able to get both of them. Or maybe he wasn't so sure. Maybe he was saying, I hope at least if I divide them up into two, so then at least one of them will be protected. One of them will survive. So in any event, the next pasuk says, V'yomer Yaakov, Elokei Avi Avraham, V'lokei Avi Yitzchak, Hashem ha'omer Elohi Yishuv L'arzachal L'aratucha V'yitiva Imach. So now he addresses God with tefillah. We know this is the third of the aspects that he does in preparation. He sends a gift, and he prepares for war, and he davens. So here he addresses God, and he says, "Katointi mikola chasadim mikola emes asher hasisa es avdecha ki v'makli avarti aser dein hazeh v'ato ha'isi l'shnei machnos." So, I am small. I am too small. So, what's the significance of saying I'm too small? So here we finally have some synergy. We haven't had so much synergy this year with the Parsha and with the Gemara Shir, but here's some synergy. The Gemara says in Masachah Shabbos and Daf Lamed Beis Amud Aleph that one should not stand in a dangerous place and rely on a miracle to save him. And even if he's lucky and there is a miracle, so then still bad because it reduces your schuyus. So you just don't want to be in a dangerous place to begin with because either it'll be bad or it'll be good, but it'll be bad still because it'll reduce your account, your spiritual account. And how do you know that? Because you see, this is how Yaakov is talking. Katonti, it sounds like I've run out of funds. It sounds like I have limited resources now spiritually because I've used them up because of what I've had to go through. So here's our synergy that the Torah Tamima comments about this Gemara over here. It says that this is why we have this idea that you're not allowed to be in a dangerous situation. It's a chamira sakanta meisura. And he goes in there, if you want to look at the Torah Tamima this week, to Chazar, recent sugyas. So he goes into the whole question of chamira sakanta meisura and chulun daf yod, and about whether there's bittul by a sakana, all the issues that some of the issues that we spoke about, so you can have a little synergy. My grandfather, Mishimus Nefesh, over there points out, he quotes the Maritz Chayis, which says something similar, but a little different than the Shmaisa that we quoted when looking at the Sugya. It says that this din of Chamira Sakanta Meisuris, who knows the din in our Torah, because we know that Pikuach Nefesh is Docha Shabbos, so therefore, even on a level of Manat Torah, we put a big emphasis on avoiding sakana. And in contrast, the Shita Sarambam is that Safik Daraisa L'chumra is only Drabana. So he's saying that by Safik Sakana, we worry about that even on a level of Manat Torah. And by Safik Ister, even with Drabana, it shows the severity here. So if you should recall, we discussed a similar point from the Shmaisa. The difference of the Shmaisa was saying that's Pshat and the Machlokas and the Gemara, whether it's Daraisa or Drabana. Here he's not necessarily inserting that into the whole discussion. It's saying that if one takes the Rambam's approach, the Safik Ister is only L'chumra midrabanan, that would seem to really contrast with Safik Sakana, where we find that it's L'chumra even on a level of Minhag Torah. There is a fascinating observation of the Vilna Gaon, that the Vilna Gaon explained the Gemara in the Masechet Sota. The Gemara says that even though Gaiva is a terrible midah, and the Rambam, the Mishnah Torah has very strong things to say about Gaiva, and the Gemara has many strong things to say about Gaiva. But the Gemara says that Talmud Chacham should have a shtickle Gaiva. Talmud Chacham should have a very little bit, Shminis Shabbat Shminis, an eighth of an eighth. So what exactly does that mean? How do you measure?
64th.
Right, so 64th. What is a 64th of Gaiva? How does that mean that everyone else brags every day and you should brag once every 2 months? What does that mean, 164th, an eighth of an eighth? How do you understand that? So the Vilna Gaon suggested that the eighth of an eighth is the eighth pasuk of the eighth parsha in the Torah. Anyone want to guess what the eighth pasuk of the eighth parsha in the Torah is? Very good. Katonti Nikola Chasad and Nikola Hamas. So that's representative of the attitude of the Talmud Chacham. But you have to flesh that out a little bit, because one could say that that's not not fitting in so well to the language of the Gemara, because that is still an expression of anivus. It sounds like when the Gemara says the Talmud Chacham has to have a shtickle gaiva, it means that a Talmud Chacham shouldn't be degraded, shouldn't demean himself, should have a little bit of self-esteem. So where do you see that in the pasuk? Where do you see that katonti is a reference to that at all? So you could say that what it means is that the Gemara is talking about being able to have a sense of chashivas as a mechayev. A person who thinks he's nothing is not going to think that he has to do anything, or that he has the ability to do anything, or that he has any achrayus to do anything. But if a person recognizes that he's been given great gifts, he's been given resources, so then that's a machayev, and a Talmid Chacham has to be able to feel inspired to move and to accomplish because he has been given great brachos. So the question is, where do you find in the Torah this attitude that a Talmid Chacham is supposed to have in order to push him further? Maybe that's what this pasuk is conveying, that here Yaakov is saying, "Katonti mikol chasadim," that I am too small for everything I've received and I have to earn it, which is consistent with what the Rosh Yeshiva was saying about the previous pasuk, that I've already been given all of these brachos and now I have to make the kinyan. I recognize that there is still that has to be done in order for that to be actually a part of me. And Rav Svengel in his drashas, so he emphasizes the idea of katan. Katan is a makabel, that we talk about, the Torah talks about the sun and the moon in Parshas Bereishis, that the sun is the mar hagadol and the moon is the mar hakatan. Sometimes they ask the trivia question, can you tell me two svarim that are named after the moon, one Rishon and one Achron? So the answer, the Achron is the Pnei Yoshua, because the Gemara says that Pnei Yoshua kechama, Pnei Moshe kechama, Pnei Yoshua kelevana, that Moshe was like the sun and Yeshua was like the moon. And there specifically, so what do you find? That the imagery is that the moon receives the sun. The sun has light. The moon doesn't have any light of its own, but it reflects the light of the sun, so that's why the moon glows. So the moon is the makabel. And so the Mar HaKatan, that's the other sefer, the Baal HaMor, is named the sefer after the moon also. That is intentional because he came from Luniel. So that's also named after the moon, so he wanted to acknowledge the place where he was from. So there, the moon is called the Marakatan. It's the Makabel from the sun, just like the Pnei Yeshua and the Pnei Moshe. So here, what he's saying is that I've received, and you would like to believe that everything is in equilibrium. You're giving and you're receiving in balance. And here Yaakov is saying, I know that it can't be. I know that I've received so much that it can't be that I've done enough to deserve it, so I'm a cotton from everything that I've received, and therefore I'm hoping to be able to live up to that. Perhaps that's also the message when you say that at a bris, we say Zakaton Gadolia, we start off as a cotton, not just as a young baby, but as somebody who is on the receiving end right now, but ultimately he should be on the level where he's able to give, where he's able to provide. What does it mean, Mikol HaChasad and Mikol HaEmes? Those are two different things. So what does that mean, Chasad and Emes? So Rashi understands that the difference is that Emes means the things that were promised, and there's a follow-through, so that's Emes. And Chasadim are the things that aren't even promised, so therefore it's just a Chesed. Ibn Ezra says a little differently that Chesed is the promise itself. And then once it's a promise, so then it has to be fulfilled. So that's the emes. The Ramban understands these aren't two separate terms. This is just a way of saying that these are chasadim that are emes, chasadim that will last, that will endure. He interprets unklus over here as a little bit of a different phrasing. So the Ramban understands unklus to mean the two different things are the sur merav, the asei tov, the being saved, and the wealth. The wealth is the other half. Lekach Tov says that the emes is what you deserve, and the chesed is more than you deserve. I think the Rambam in Maravuchim says something similar to that. Shem Shemafel Hirsch has comments like this in his various places in Chumash, and understand exactly how chesed correlates to what you deserve. So Vata Yisul Shnei Machnos. So now I'm in two camps. So what does that convey? My brother always likes to point out that he called this the raisin bran problem, because raisin bran is cereal, so they'd advertise that they have two scoops of raisins. But that's not significant, because there's no minimum shear for a scoop, so you don't know how big a scoop they're using. So maybe they're using a tiny scoop, so they have two scoops. It doesn't mean so much. Maybe you'd rather have one big scoop, and what's the chap of having two scoops? So you're saying now I could be two machnas, so, but we don't know how big the machnas are. It's not necessarily better than one big machna. Why is he talking about how lucky he is as far as that's concerned? So, you could say it means the fact that it's kidei chalukah is significant. The fact that it's enough that it can be divided into two is something to focus on as a way of having a positive appreciation. Or it could be, as my brother would also point out, that similar to what we were saying before, that the hardship is also a part of the growth process. So to be able to recognize, okay, these are the kind of challenges I have, you know, in a sense, maybe you'd call it like a first world problem. The problem is, okay, so I have to break up my camp in order to be able to defend against these opposing forces, but at least I have an estate that is able to be broken up, and that I have the problem of having too much to defend rather than not having anything to defend in the first place and having to strategize about it. That's also something that we have to be able to appreciate and to recognize what that means. So then he says, Sahatsilainina biarachim yareisav, ki orani achoso penyavo vikani, emal banim. I'm worried, so save me from my brother, from Esav. Why do you need both of those? Mi'arachim, mi'ar-Esav. First, we'll talk about different approaches. Maybe part of tefillah is you have to be very specific and not leave any room for misinterpretation. Or maybe he's emphasizing that, yeah, he's my brother, but he doesn't act like it. He acts like somebody who's after me. Or some say that maybe he's acknowledging that maybe he had not acted so brotherly towards Esav, or maybe that's the point, that the issue of brotherhood is what got between them, the issue of the Bechorah. And that's what he has to acknowledge here. But at the end of the day, so I do have this Havtacha, V'yata amarta heitiv heitiv imach, V'samti azaracha kechol hayom, Ashal yisofer merov, you've promised me that we're going to be a great nation, so please save me. And here, you could say, this seems to contradict it. Before we said he's concerned, he doesn't think the promise is maybe going to last, and now he's invoking the promise. Or maybe that's the point. He's saying that I don't know if I'm deserving, and I don't ever want to rely on my own zchus. That's one of the lessons that's derived from this parasha that the Ramban mentioned before, that we don't try to come to a Kadosh Baruch Hu and say, give me this because I deserve it. We don't try to make that argument. It's always a risky argument. But we say that maybe I don't deserve it, but at least there's a haftacha. So I'm trying to invoke that, and I'm not claiming that I'm worthy, but at least mitam the haftacha and the future that is all supposed to connect from this, that hopefully that should bring about a hatzalah. So there's a lot to think about, again, especially in an era of tragically increasing anti-Semitism. So we turn to all of these methods. We turn to tefillah for sure. And this theme also, that we're invested in the future, that we are promised and therefore confident and very concerned ourselves that there should be a future that will continue the mission that we have been given, and therefore, at least because that, there should be a Yeshua for Klal Yisrael, that the Jewish people should be able to endure and to thrive based on the understanding that that's the Kadosh Baruch Hu's plan, that's the plan that we have ourselves invested in and bonded to, and through that joint commitment, through that joint effort, we should be saved from all tzaras, and we should know no more tragedies like we heard about this week. Everyone, a wonderful Shabbos.